And I think to yourself that is for the benefit of all of our mothers, all sentient beings who are as limitless as space, that we need to attain Buddhahood. And in order to attain Buddhahood, we need to practice the Dharma. And in order to practice the Dharma, we have to understand the Dharma. And so for that reason, we do the listening and the contemplation of the Dharma. And so with this attitude of bodhicitta, please listen to these teachings of the Dharma this morning. And the Dharma that we are going through is the is based upon the fourth chapter of Vasubandhu's Treasury of Abhidharma, the presentation of karma from the Abhidharma teachings. So just a brief background on what this text is, because today we're going to go a lot more through the texts that we have here. And so this text comes from an Indian master named Vasubandhu, who was Asanga's younger brother. There was the great master Asanga who met Maitreya and all that. You may have heard the story. His younger brother was Vasubandhu, who studied first with the masters in Kashmir of the Vaibhashika, or Great Exposition School. So these are masters of what is called in Sanskrit the Hinayana, or we can say in English, the foundation vehicle. But his brother was a great master of the Mahayana, so he went to go meet his brother. And he went back to central India and met his brother, and at first didn't believe it, didn't accept the Mahayana, but then he saw the error in his ways. And he's actually one of the few masters who actually composed great treatises in both traditions. So this treatise that we're looking at now, he wrote a little bit later, after he'd already started practicing the Mahayana. But he wrote it according to the teachings of the Kashmiri Great Exposition School, which is a particular subsect of the foundation vehicles. And so when you read this presentation of karma, you read other presentations of the karma, there may be slight differences, because there are different presentations of karma in different teachings. And I'll point out a few of those differences as we go along, but I'm not going to go into them in depth because it's not germane to our to necessarily what we need to get out of it. But this is, you know, as the teaching from the foundation vehicle, this is a very basic presentation of karma, very profound, actually. Sometimes we get the idea you've got the Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana, and the Vajrayana is the only one that's worth anything, actually. You get that idea. The Vajrayana is truly profound, and the others are just sort of like, you know, milk toast. It's not like that at all. It really isn't. In studying this text, I was just amazed at, when you really think about it, what these positions actually mean. The actual implications of them are really very, very profound. It's a very, we may talk about them. Okay, they say that time has actual existence, that past objects have substantial existence. Come on, you can't say that. They're gone. They're nothing. But when you start thinking about it, there is a real point there that they're making. Okay, we aren't going to get to that issue. That's in the next chapter. Come to Crestone and I'll teach you all about that. Maybe. I'm thinking about leaving it out there, too. Boy, you got to... Oh, tea. Good. Let's see. If it's here and it's warm. So at any rate, so we have to keep in perspective, generally when you are studying Buddhism, there are a lot of different presentations, and sometimes you may get confused. You wonder, my teacher said this, and this book says the other thing. Don't worry about it. Different presentations are given for different people for different reasons. They all have the points that they're making. They all come to the same place at the end. All Dharma agrees on one point. That being said, we'll now get into the discussion. So last night we talked about the general background information that there are previous and future lives, and how is it the mechanics of how rebirth work. And so now we'll get into the actual discussion of karma. Those things are taught in the third chapter of the Treasury of Abhidharma, which teaches primarily the truth of suffering. When you think about this world, what is the world? The world is suffering, the three types of suffering. So how is it that the world came to be? It's because of the truth of origin. So from karma, various worlds are born. We touched on this in one of the questions last night. Basically, what Buddhism is saying is different from what most scientific presentations say. Most scientific presentations, as I explained last night, basically you have matter first, and then somehow consciousness arose out of that. Everything comes from a cause in the scientific presentation, but the cause is primarily material. And there are good reasons to look at it that way, because we can actually measure the matter, whereas you can't measure mind so easily. With Buddhism, it's different. All of the material things are created by our karma. First, there was the karmic wind, and then because of the karmic wind, there was a mandala of wind that formed. And then on the mandala of wind, you had the mandala of water, and then from that getting churned, there came the earth. And then it's on the earth that we have the world as we know it. That's the traditional description of it. But at any rate, it's first the karmic wind. The collective karma of all sentient beings created the world. And there are many different universes, many different worlds. As they say, some are sideways, some are flat, some are tall, all sorts of different. Some are upside down, they even say. Can you imagine a world where everywhere you walked on the ceiling? Just go to Australia. So it's karma that creates the world, and as I said last night, this is because karma is basically the effect on our mind stream, and the world comes out of our projections of the mind stream. You can think of the world as being either entirely our perceptions or completely filtered through our perceptions, so that everything we experience in the world comes out of our mind. And so because it comes out of our mind, the actions that we do have an effect on our mind stream, and that's how they produce the karmic effect, essentially. This is when we say the eighth consciousness is the storehouse consciousness in other teachings, not in this text. What we mean there is, basically, you do something, it has an effect on the continuum of your mind, right? So, well, if karma is something that has an effect on the continuum of the mind, well, what is karma? I mean, what types of karma are there? And as it continues, volition and what that creates. So volition, that is what we call mental karma, the mental actions. It's, deciding to do something or having the wish to do something. And then what that creates is karma, action of body and speech. Now, here there is a difference between different schools. And in this school, actually what they say is that the volition isn't like real karma. It's like a karmic path that leads you on the way to doing things, but it's not really action. Action is body and speech. That means if we had to think about action as being one of the five skandhas, which of the five skandhas would it be? Is it consciousness? No. And is it like formation, all the thoughts that happen in your mind? No. So what is it?
Form.
So this is an interesting thing. Rinpoche once said it to me a few years ago. He said, a prostration is a visual form. It's like, oh yeah, it's something you can see. It's like a visual form. When you say something, that's something that can be heard by the ear, something that can be perceived by the ear. Right? So our actions here in the presentation of this school are forms. They're what we do. And they're things that we can perceive with our five senses. So that's basically what we're saying. When we talk about the karma that we have the most control over, because we don't have a lot of control over our mind until we train further, but we can, it's hard to stop your mind from thinking of things. It's easier. Not necessarily pretty easy. It's easier to stop yourself from acting on things, to stop yourself from doing the actions of body and speech, right? So that's basically what we're talking about. So volition is mental karma, which creates the body karma of body and speech. Those of you who were at the teachings of, when Rinpoche gave the Kenpo Gongshar teachings in Maine a couple of years ago, 2007, was it?
Eight.
No, it wasn't nine. It was 2007, I'm pretty sure. And in those, you might remember the Kenpo Gongshar talked about, well, what is primary? It's mind that's primary, because you don't do anything unless you think of it first. Mm-hmm. This is saying exactly the same thing in more technical terms, right? So one of the tricks about taking a text like this is it looks dry, and then you think, well, what does this actually mean? And you discover it's anything but. It's actually got a lot of that. But it's, you know, usually when you read Western Buddhist literature, especially written by Westerners, you get lots of cute stories about, you know, the therapist's patients and, you know, the rabbis. They always have stories about rabbis. I'm not sure why. they don't always, but they often do. What was I going to say? I got distracted. Kenpo Gongshar. Yeah, and this is, so, you know, we put it in very homey, you know, everyday sort of things, in terms. And here it's presented in very dry philosophical terms. It's talking about exactly the same thing. But one of the things that's good about this is that it makes it a much more sort of general, and you can actually get right in on what the actual issue is. But then you do have to sort of think, well, what does this actually mean for my life? So we have volition and what that types and what that creates. And so basically that means that anything you do is motivated by something, right? So I skipped a few verses in the actual text in here. We come to verse 10, which says, the two motivations are the causal and the contemporaneous motives. So you think about it, there are two types of motivations. There's the causal motivation, which is, I'm hungry, I'm going to go kill a chicken to eat. And you go, you get your knife, you go, and then you kill the chicken, cut off its head. And the motivation at the two moments, the motivation that you decide, I'm going to go do this, and the motivation that you have at the time that you actually do it, are different. In that instance of, I'm hungry, I'm going to go kill a chicken, that's desire. I'm hungry. I want something for me. Then when you go to the kill the chicken, that is aggression and aversion at that moment. That's a negative example. But we also have more positive examples. The one that Rinpoche always mentions at the beginning. When you come to it, of course you have a good motivation when you come to a teaching like this, but we can always change. We're sentient beings, and so it's important to then have another good motivation. So Rinpoche always says something like this at the beginning of a teaching, often does. This is because you signed up for this. I'm going to do this. I want to learn about this topic. And then you get here, you know, in the morning you get a phone call. Oh, you know, this good friend of yours has cancer. And then you're coming here and you're thinking about something else. You've got a completely neutral, I have to go because I signed up. Actually, your mind is somewhere else, and you've got a neutral motivation for being here. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Something like that can happen. So the first one is the instigator, the second one is the executor. The instigator is the one that gets you to do something, and then you actually have to do it, and you have a different motivation. So these are the sort of two different motivations that we can talk about. Let's see. The consciousness that seeing discards is the instigator. Let's move on. Let's skip to verse 12. Let's not overburden you with things that are not so useful at the moment. So the executors from the virtuous and others instigators are threefold. What this means is that you might have like a virtuous causal motivation. The instigator is virtuous. You decide that you want to take the example they give in the text. You decide you want to take vows. That's a virtuous motivation. Then you get to the actual vow ceremony, and at the moment when the master snaps his fingers and gives you the vows, you could have a continuation of that virtuous motivation. You could be completely distracted and have a neutral motivation, or you could be angry at the guy next to you. Right? Any of those three things can happen. The sages are alike or virtuous. The Buddha always has either neutral or virtue. He never has unvirtue. And so his instigators maybe neutral, but the may be neutral and then ripen as, then he may have the virtuous executors. But if he has a virtuous executor, he always has a virtuous instigator. He always has a virtuous executor. And then those born of ripening are neither. Those born of ripening, in other words, those motivations that we have that come out of the full ripening of karma are not virtuous, they are not non-virtuous. This is a very important point, although it doesn't look it. People come up and they say, I get so angry, I have such terrible time, and I always feel like hitting people and do such terrible things, and it's my karma. That is not the ripening of your karma. The ripening of your karma is what we call a result of full ripening, is neutral. It's an experience of pain, pleasure, or neutral. That is how karma ripens. It ripens as a sensation. Okay? So it's the sensation of the pain. Where your mind goes from that can be virtuous or non-virtuous or neutral. That's a different thing. But the actual ripening of karma is neutral in terms of the full ripening. So this is an important point, because you might think to yourself, oh, I always get angry. It's the ripening of my karma. It's terrible. I should do something about it. It's not. You don't have a lot of control over the ripening of karma, but you have a lot of control over what you do with it. Now, this being said, it can be the tendency to act this way is what we'd call a compatible result. And this in some ways is a compatible result, is one type of result of karma. But it's not the result of karma. It's not the ripening result of karma. It's just that you have ingrained habits, and so it's what we call a compatible result. You have a compatible cause, which is like you get angry, and it makes you habituated to being angry, which then has the compatible action that you continue to get angry, right? Is that clear? This is a very important point to keep in mind. Okay? So, those born of ripening. So if you have a motivation that arises because of the ripening of karma, that is not a motivation that's going to, it's neutral, it's not going to motivate you to do anything. It might be you get hungry because of the ripening of karma and you want to eat something. And you do it in a virtuous way. Or in a neutral way. So that's the type of motivations. When you have that type of motivations, well, what sort of actions do those lead us to do? When we talk about the different types of karma, we're talking about the different types of actions that we can do. And so that's what the next section that I included here has. I skipped a whole bunch of stuff here that would just give you headaches at this point. So we'll go to this part. The pleasant, unpleasant, and other karma are virtue, non-virtue, and other. So what is, we talk about virtue or positive, non-virtue or negative, and other or neutral karma a lot. So what do we mean when we say virtuous karma? Virtuous karma basically means that karma that's going to produce a pleasant result. Something that feels good, pleasurable, nice, okay? Non-virtuous actions are actions that are going to produce a unpleasant result, painful, whatever, okay? And the neutral actions produce a neutral result, right? So this is what, when we say virtue, that's what we mean. It's not like there is some greater being. It's not like there is Yama, the Lord of Death, who is deciding what is virtuous and not. Although there's talk of Yama, the Lord of Death, judging your karma, it actually isn't like that. That's just a way to make it easier for people to understand when they have no education. The actual way it works is that it's just the nature of good actions that they produce good results. If you plant the seeds of a grapevine, you're going to get sweet grapes, right? You've got sweet seeds leading to a sweet result. If you plant chili pepper seeds, you're going to get hot results, right? and chili pepper seeds are actually the hottest part of the seed too, of the pepper, you know. So you've got that really hot seed, and it produces a really hot result, right? And that's the analogy. It's like, you know, good acts lead to good results. So this is pretty easy. If we want to experience good results, we need to do good actions. We also talk about merit, non-merit, and unmoving karma. So merit, non-merit, and unmoving are three different types of karma. And then there are the three experienced as pleasure, etc. So pleasure, pain, or suffering, and neutral. So these are just different ways we can talk about karma. And so the merit is the virtuous karma of the desire realm. So this means basically we are current. There are three. Do you know about the three realms of existence, right? What are the three realms of existence? Desire, right? We're in the desire realm. Then we have the form realm and the formless realm. Three realms, right? So the desire realm is basically what we talk about is the six realms, the six classes of beings. You've got the hells, hunger, ghosts, animals, humans, the demigods, and then you have the gods, the desire realm. Then there is the second of the three realms is the form realm. The form realm is when you perfect states of jhana meditation, then you can be reborn in the form realms. And you can do this either through worldly meditations or through noble meditations, that is the meditation, the Buddhist meditations. And if you do that, then you have so that's the form realm. And then there are the formless realms, which are four additional levels that are created by four even deeper states of, basically they're very deep states of shamatha meditation, extremely deep states of shamatha meditation. So that's unmoving karma. Those are produced by what we call unmoving karma, because when you do the meditations of jhana or the formless meditations, they lead to rebirth in the jhana and the form realms. And they don't ripen anywhere else, and so it doesn't move from anywhere. It's unmoving. We don't practice these meditations much in this tradition. We don't practice them at all in this tradition. They do practice them in the Theravada tradition. You need to know the word, and you know that it's there, and it's something you can do, but it's not too important. What's important to us is the merit and the merit and the non-merit. So merit is the virtuous karma of desire, and non-merit is the unvirtuous karma that we do. So basically, merit and non-merit, when you talk about actions, are pretty much the same. Merit and virtue are pretty much the same. Non-virtue and non-merit are pretty much the same. When you do a virtuous karma includes the unmoving karma. And so if you do the first few lines, virtue is experienced as pleasure through the third jhana. Above that, it's felt as neither pain nor pleasure. So basically, when you have the jhana and the formless meditations, in some of the jhana states, you go beyond, in the fourth jhana and in the four formless, there's not even any sense of pleasure, mental or physical pleasure. It's beyond that, because those senses, experiences of pleasure are slightly coarse compared to the more refined levels of meditation. And so on those levels, if you do a virtuous thing, it's not experienced as pleasure. But in the desire realm where we are, if we do virtuous things in the desire realm, then it will lead to pleasant results. And so non-virtue is felt here as suffering. So we do non-virtuous actions in the desire realm, and we experience the results of these as pain, as suffering, right? Either physical, primarily as physical pain, not necessarily as mental pain. When you think about it, mental pain is generally not neutral. It's either virtuous or it's unvirtuous. It's not neutral, right? So when you get upset about something, if you're upset about something and you're upset because you see someone else suffering and you feel upset because you want to help them and don't know what to do, that's a motivation of compassion. That's a virtuous state of mind. It's not necessarily a particularly helpful state of mind, but it may be a virtuous state of mind. If you get upset because someone has done something that you don't like, then that's motivated by aversion, which is unvirtuous, right? So unhappiness, displeasure in your mind is always either virtue or non-virtue. Because of that, it cannot be the result of full ripening of karma, right? Because the full ripening of karma is just the mere experience of a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling. And it's always, in its essence, it is always neutral. So karma does not ripen. When you feel upset in your mind, that is not karma. Is that? Yeah. It's so this is something you can think about, you know. it's
you, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
So it's not considered an action thought, the virtuous thought or non-virtuous thought? Or is it?
It is either a virtuous thought or an unvirtuous thought, but it is not necessarily an action. Okay? It's just a thought, actually. Sort of an aside here, we tend to give a lot of importance to our emotional states in this culture. This is culture specific. It is not universal. In Buddhism, in traditional Tibetan, there is no word that corresponds to, no single word that corresponds to the word emotions. The word emotion did not enter the English language until the mid-17th century. It is not necessarily a useful concept. and they are not, they're just events in our mind like any other event in our mind. This is where the sort of cold approach of Abhidharma makes a lot of sense. You know, it's like you don't have to get caught up in all of these. You know, emotions are just things that occur in your mind. They are mental feelings, nothing more. And so we do not need to be as attached to them. When they come up to us, they do not come up entirely out of our control. They are not the ripening of karma. Where do they come from? Habituation. Clinging to yourself. And then we train ourselves to think, oh, my emotions are so important. And we learn from the young age, how do you feel? You're 3 years old. Yeah. Oh, good. How do you feel? Are you happy today? Your feelings are important. You're important. And so all we're doing, you know, is from the very young age, we're telling kids what you feel, what you grasp on as being me and mine is so important.
Are you saying then that those feelings in terms of the 10 non-virtues are coming from the non-virtue of wrong views, the mental non-virtue of wrong views?
They're coming from the root affliction of the personality view or the view of self.
Okay.
One of the ten kernels or the ten subtle afflictions that we all have in our being. So how is it that we experience the results of karma? And that's what this next thing says. We experience karma in basically five different ways. So inherently, concurrently, through focus as full ripening, or else directly manifesting. So when we experience karma inherently, the results of karma, we're experiencing it as pleasure, suffering, or neutral. So it's a feeling, it's a sensation, right? Concurrently, that means concurrent is a word here. It means basically associated with the mind. So you have there is a feeling that you experience that can that is capable of producing pain, pleasure, or neutral. And so these are the associated mental factors that arise at the same time as that. So the associated mental factors are like the like feeling, volition, contact, and so forth, and also the virtuous mental factors such as faith, non-greed, non-hostility, non-delusion, shame, a sense of shame and modesty, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Or they might be the unvirtuous ones like spite, grudge, resentment, jealousy, and so forth. Right. So they're basically those things coming up. In that respect, our emotions do come up as, because emotions are all those variations of mental factors or mixtures of them, they do come up as a concurrent result of karma. They're not the ripening of karma. And then through focus, this means that when you have an object that you're focusing on that is capable of producing a feeling of pleasure, pain, or a neutral feeling. And then as full ripening, so this is again just the experience. Full ripening is something that the ripening of a result of karma that you experience is pain, pleasure, or neutral. Or directly manifesting. Boy, these are all sounding the same. They're just sort of different ways of conceptualizing it. Directly manifesting means that you directly perceive it, basically. You directly perceive the experience of the pain or the experience of the neutral or the experience of the unpleasant experience. But basically what we're talking about is that you experience the results in one of, broadly in one of three ways, you know, pain, pleasure, or neutral. So that you're all sort of sitting here looking. Yeah. Should we? Why don't we just take a moment here for a little bit of discussion and see what you all are. Yeah.
So you said earlier by pain you mean just mainly physical pain, as a direct.
In terms of the full ripening of karma. Would be physical pain, physical suffering, but not mental suffering. With the other ones, with the concurrent, if it's a concurrent result of karma, you can say that then that could also be include mental suffering, unhappiness. Amy, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I was just thinking that, you know, when I say the dedication prayer, I often think, you know, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, I always think, what about mental suffering? Because what I see around me, the pain that I notice is so much generated by mental states. You know, that I feel like that's what's happening in our culture, and often with me, like, I'm reasonably healthy, but I feel that I'm suffering. I'm putting myself through all this stuff mentally.
Mm-hmm.
So, that... I guess I'm confused about that because I feel like that's even, I understand what you're saying and it's really helpful, but I feel like in the actual world that we live in, the mental suffering causes so many of the actions
that
we see around us going awry.
The mental suffering motivates the actions. It's not the result of the actions. This is the distinction I'm drawing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In terms of the dedication prayer, that comes from 2,550 years ago.
Right. That's what I always
think. At that time, when you read the stories in the Vinaya about what life was like in India at the time of the Buddha, it was not a picnic. Disease, dying, robbers, bandits, you had to be careful walking outside. There are lots of stories about people who would get, you know, about monks and nuns who were beaten up and murdered by thieves and so forth. So that was a situation where the physical suffering was so manifest that I think mental suffering took a back seat. You even see that when you go to countries like Nepal. Now, you know, people are so overwhelmed by the physical difficulties that they don't even think about the mental difficulties. But of course, in the dedication, the mental difficulties are... You know, we've got eight different types of suffering in the human realm. There's the four listed there. Then there's not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, being too busy, and Jalpong. What is it? I'm terrible. I've lost the eighth one. Forgotten the eighth one. At any rate, you know, not getting what you want and getting what you don't want are pretty much most of our mental sufferings.
So they can cause karma, but they're not the result of karma?
They're mental states, and they can cause you to perform actions which are karma, right? But they are not the result. They don't come up because of the result of... It's not the full ripened result. It may be a compatible result. It's part of the conditioning that are... In other words, it's part of the conditioning that... Those mental states are the conditioning that is created by our past actions, but they are not the ripening of those actions. So do you see the distinction?
Yeah. Is it how you deal with the mental states when you have them? You know, like, I'm thinking about now, say, depression is caused by imbalances in the body, so that would, you know, that would be a karmic consequence in your body, maybe. And you have this condition called depression because of that chemical imbalance in your body. So how you handle the depression is what matters in your virtuous or non-virtuous deeds.
Yeah, the well, that's actually a very good question, because you know, the condition of your body may well be a result, the full ripening of karma. There may be other causes, there may be other coincidental causes, but generally our bodies are the result of that. The important thing, the important lesson of this is not to, is to look forward. This is the whole point about karma. So when you sort of understand how things go, then you can look forward. And if you've got a physical condition that is leading to mental, to a particular mental condition, then you can deal with that physical condition and then move on from there. You know, that's the whole point. So, you know, if you have a, you know, that whatever serotonin problem in the brain, and you need to take the medications to deal with that, so that then you can act virtuously and train yourself in good things and practice meditation and function. Fine, that's great. The point is that we need to. The point of karma is that however it is we got here, we can look forward and we can move ahead in that way. Is that?
Yeah, well, I was thinking of her question and how so many people are struggling with mental issues and... you know, how you can help somebody through the practice with mental issues in whatever capacity they have, I guess.
The other question is to think about what is the actual causal relationship between the chemical imbalances in the brain and the mental experience of depression. Are they a cause? Are they a mechanism, or what? It's hard to tell. I mean, I don't have a lot of experience. I haven't studied that so much. I'm going to have to think about that one.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm just using my own experience. When you yesterday mentioned when we did a lot of misconception about karma, and sometimes I use this karma to against myself or other people. Like if I have a health condition, I say that this is my karma caused it.
Mm-hmm.
And that attitude could also to other people suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And how can we turn around that mental or that self-condemnations to something more compassionate and constructive?
Well, I think the first step is sort of recognizing the nature of it. The health condition is a result of karma, but your reaction to it is not. And so this is a health condition that I have. And then if it leads you to produce negative, unvirtuous mind states that you then act upon, you actually have control over that. And so you may not feel like you have control over it yet, but you can develop that control. That's what we, you know, that's why we're practicing, practicing here. So if you having the illness may well be the result of karma, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to use that in some way against other people or try to get other things. It's just really, you have to distinguish between what's occurring and the thoughts in your mind that are thinking, that are making you think about the motivations for the actions that you do from now on. Do you see what I'm saying?
So almost like, you know, whatever health condition, whatever condition, disaster, it's a fact.
Yeah.
You know, the fact may be caused by karma. And
yeah.
It is caused by karma in our belief system. Then, and how that mutual then move and turn your mind into more virtuous
right.
direction.
The experience of pain, pleasure, the mere experience of pain or pleasure is neutral. When that is, motivates you to feel craving, greed for pleasure, and aversion, antipathy, or hatred from the unpleasant, then those are the non-virtuous. But that's not the result of the karma. The karma is just the sensation, basically. The result of the karma is the full ripened result is just that sensation. Okay, let's move on a little bit. So, when we do karma, when we do an action, we need to think about, well, when is it going to have a result? When is it going to have a bear its result? Generally, when we talk about ripening results of karma, they could happen any time after you do the action, sometime after you do the action. Well, are they definitely going to happen, or what? And so when we talk about karma, some actions that we do are going to have definite results, and some aren't going to have definite results. So there's definite and indefinite karma. So they're definite or indefinite. There are three definite because there's visibly experienced, etc. So what this means, there are some actions that you do where you have such a strong motivation, or the being whom you do it to, or the motivation is so strong, then because of that, it's such a strong action that the result is experienced in this life. That's what we call visibly experienced. Visibly experienced means we're going to see the result sometime in this life. If it's a little bit less strong, then it's what we call the experienced on rebirth. So that's the second time. So you've got visibly experienced on rebirth. And then you've got some that's strong enough that you're definitely going to get have the ripening result of that karma. But it's not strong enough that you're going to experience it in this lifetime or the next lifetime. It's going to be experienced in some other lifetimes. And so that's what we call karma that is experienced in other lifetimes. Right? So these are the three types of definite karma. The visibly experienced, that's experienced, you experience the ripening in this life, the karma experienced on rebirth, and the karma experienced in another lifetime. And so when that's happened depends upon the causes and the conditions coming together. But it's you definitely have to experience the result of that karma. Then there are some that's even weaker. You're not much of a motivation, but you do something. And that's indefinitely experienced. It's indefinite how it's going to be experienced. It's indefinite when it's going to be experienced. And so when the causes and conditions come together for that karmic seed, for that tendency, for that disturbance in your mind stream to be experienced, then it'll manifest as some sort of a karmic experience. But if they don't come together for a long time, then, you know, they aren't necessarily, they aren't definitely experienced, or they it's not definite when they will be experienced. When Rinpoche teaches this, Rinpoche, to make it easy to understand, says that this is like the karma that's very easy to purify. So you purify karma basically by regretting it, then using the power of support like a great master or the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, and using an antidote, which is practicing virtue of some sort, and then resolving never to do it again. If you do those four things, you can purify your karma. So Rinpoche, when he teaches this, sometimes it sounds like this last type of karma, the karma that is not definitely experienced, is the type of karma that you can purify. Actually, you can purify any karma. This is going to try to talk more about this tomorrow, but I just want to bring this point up now because this is where Rinpoche often makes this point. Yes?
Could you please repeat those four?
Okay, the four types of karma are the karma that is visibly experienced.
No, the one, the purification.
Oh, the four supports, the powers of the four supports. There is the power of regret, which is regretting what you've done. The power of support, which is making your confession to the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. There is the power of antidote, which is doing strong virtue. And the power of resolve, which is extremely important. I'm never going to do that again. Okay? So we got those four basic types of karma, basically the definite and the indefinite and the various gradations of when it's going to... So how do we know that karma is going to have a definite ripening, that an action is going to have a definite ripening? It's really by the strength of the action, the strength of the motivation, and the strength of the and the strength of the object who receives the action. So here's what it says. An action done out of intense afflictions or sincerity to the field of qualities, continuous or killing parents, that is definite. So when you do it out of the intense afflictions or out of sincerity, it's going to be definitely experienced. So if you make offerings out of really strong faith, that is going to have a definite result. If you just sort of go in and you think to yourself, okay, oh yeah, it's the beginning of the session, I have to... yeah, I have to make an offering of incense. Okay, here's the incense offering. Not much, you know. Because look at it, you know, you don't have much of a thought in your mind. But if you're sitting there, oh, this is an offering of incense. I'm giving it to all of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas. I'm picturing all of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of me. And may they all smell the wonderful scent of this incense. And it may the result of this offering bring all sentient beings to the unlimited state of Buddhahood. And you make that offering with that thought. I never do, actually. I should do as I speak. At any rate, you make it with that thought. Then it has a real definite result. It's like a really strong, right? Basically, when we're talking about if something's going to have a definite result, it's got to make a really strong impression on you, right? So the stronger the intention you do it with, the stronger the intention. Then to the field of qualities. So like in that example, the field of qualities is, oh, here I'm making this offering. There's the Gyalon Karmapa's picture on the shrine. I'm giving this to the Gyalon Karmapa and thinking in this way. This is, you know, definite, right? Or if you actually go to Dharamsala and see the Gyalon Karmapa, or you see Trungpa Rinpoche and, you know, make offerings to them or to other great masters who come through Portland or wherever it is that you end up. So that's another way that karma is definite. Then there is the continuous, frequent. Like if you're in the habit of doing something, it may not be a big thing, but you're in the habit of doing it and you just always do it. Right? It may be a very small action. So actually, if you just come in here out of rote and every day you make an incense offering and some days you remember to think about it and some days you don't, but you make the offering anyways, you're doing it every day, every single day. So even if you can't remember to have that vast motivation, it's still going to have that definite result. Or to make a prostration when we come in. You come in, you see the shrine, and you pay respect and you bend down and you touch all five of your points, completely humbling yourself before the the sources of protection, the sources of refuge. Doing that, you know, some days it's like, okay, the Lama sat down, we got to prostrate. And you do that enough times, you know. That's the continuous. But you can also have the strong. Let's see. And then killing parents, that has a definite result. Did I leave those parts in or take them out? We don't want to get off on the issues of surrogate motherhood and things like that. But they are addressed in this text, actually. When you have a surrogate parent, or when you were born from an egg donor, who is your actual mother? Mm-hmm. It's the one, according to this text, just as an aside, it is the one from whose menstrual cycle you are born. Basically the one whose ovum you are born out of. That is what your mother is. And the reason that killing the parents or doing anything to your parents is so much stronger is because they're so kind to us. We have to remember this. In this culture, we have hard times with our parents, with our moms, with our parents, primarily our moms, both of them. And part of this, I think this is 90% cultural. Mm. Tibetans don't have this problem. Nepalis don't have this problem. Indians don't have this problem. Chinese people, by and large, don't have the problem the way Western people do. Of course, you know, there's friction with your parents, but it's not like my mom did this to me, now I'm suffering. You know, we've got this whole shtick that we start through psychology and pop psychology, you know, the Oedipus complex and the electric complex, that all of our psychological problems come out of our parents. And then now we're saying, well, it comes out of, you know, out of your brain chemistry. Well, we get that from our parents too, you know. Yeah. And then we, all this. And so,
I can't blame my mom. Who can I blame?
So, parents are wonderful. They're so kind. Some of them, okay, there are exceptions. We have to take that into account. And if you feel that your parents are the exceptions, then so be it. But by and large, for most of us, parents are really do wonderful things, but they are ordinary people. My parents are wonderful. I'm very fortunate. So those are the things that are definite karma, okay? So what the definite karma, the strongest definite karma, is the karma with visible results. You do something in this life with a really strong, definite wish, and it brings you results in this life. The karma with visible, that karma has visible results from excellence of field and intention. So the examples in the commentary. There was a bhikshu, a full monk at the time of the Buddha, who got really annoyed at the other members of the Sangha. And he started calling them. He said, "You're a bunch of women." Meaning in a very derogatory way. As a result of that, actually, sometime later, his sex spontaneously changed and he became a woman. Yeah. In that very life. There are many recorded examples of this in the Vinaya literature of people changing sexes, and this is one of them. It was a result of him making that. Another one was, there was the king Kanaka, who was impotent, and there were 500 bulls that were about to be castrated, you know, to make them more tame. And what he did is he bought them all and he saved them all from castration. And as a result of that, he gained his potency back. Better than Viagra. From stable detachment to the level when it has definite full ripening. So when you do meditation and you get to a point where you've freed yourself from the obscurations, the desire realm, and you can be reborn in the form realm, but you've still got desire realm karma that's waiting to be ripened. So if you don't purify that karma, it's going to ripen upon you in this lifetime. So those are the things that make visible results. And others that make make karma swiftly experienced are to help or harm those risen from cessation, unprovocative love, or seeing, or our heart's result bring swiftly experienced results. So basically, those who if you see someone who is in a deep meditation, like the meditation of cessation, the absorption of cessation, or they might be in what's called the unprovocative absorption, which is a state where they're meditating on not provoking afflictions in anyone else, or if they're meditating on love, loving kindness, or if they're if they have just achieved the path of seeing, in other words, seeing the nature of reality as it is, or if it's an arhat who is meditating upon, who has just attained the result of an arhat. If you see a being like this, and you make an offering, or you circumambulate them, or you pay them respects, then this has very, very strong results. So when someone just arises from that absorption, then you make offerings to them. That is a very strong, strong karmic experience. I think I want to stop here in terms of the material that we're covering. There are a couple of stanzas now that come up that actually talk about your question that you were just asking. So I want to review the commentary on those before I go through them again in light of what you were asking to see about what we can talk about. So we'll start out with that in the afternoon, the virtuous karma, starting with verse 57 in the afternoon. So I think now we've got some time for questions, discussion.
Would you backtrack just a little bit and describe full ripening again?
When we talk about full ripening, there are two things. There's the cause of full ripening, and there is the result of full ripening. When we talk about the cause of full ripening, that is something that it's either virtuous or unvirtuous, and as it says in the commentary, it's moistened by craving. There is craving that goes along with it. So you're doing an action, and there is some aspect of craving. This can be craving for something. This can be craving for the destruction of something. At any rate, some sort of grasping or craving that goes with it. So you do an act that's virtuous or unvirtuous, and there is craving along with that, then that is going to produce a fully ripened result. And it's because it's strong. You've got, like, craving is really strong, right? And when you have a virtue or an unvirtue, they're really strong. So that's giving some impetus to the karma. Mm-hmm. If the action doesn't have any impetus, it's not going to produce enough of an effect or an imprint upon your mind stream to be able to actually ripen in the future. So if you do something neutral out of craving, then it doesn't have that same strength. For example, you think if you feel craving for, your favorite food, and you walk over to where that food is, taking each step is a neutral action, right? Mm-hmm. It's not positive, it's not neutral, you're just going. You know, you've got the craving going at the same time, but taking those steps is not creating any real impression upon your being, right? You can think about this.
You're directed by your intention.
You're directed by your intention. The point when you actually, you get to your food and then you eat it with great craving and greedily, that has an impression on you, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a very strong one. I mean, it's not a huge an issue, but it's something we can think about. You know, when you do something neutral, even if there's craving involved, it doesn't make enough of an impression. So neutral means that you don't have a virtuous motivation, you don't have a non-virtuous motivation, you're just sort of doing it. And there are many of the things that we do are neutral. Walking, sitting, whatever. Okay? Then there's the result of full ripening. So the result of full ripening, you've done something, the cause of full ripening, you've done the action that's going to cause full ripening. That full ripening ripens as an experience, something that you see, feel, hear, feel in your mind, any of the experiences that you can have that ripens in a way that is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, mm-hmm. Right? So, for example, the classic thing about full ripening is that you do something that makes you take birth as a human. So, taking birth as a human requires a lot of virtue. So you've done a lot of virtue in some previous life, and that virtue then comes together at the point where you actually are able to take birth. You know, you've got, as we said last night, you've got the sperm and the ovum, and you've got the consciousness all coming together. So at the moment of doing that, there is a sensation. It's a sensation of getting in there, and there's a feeling of, this is mine at the moment. The sensation when you have the experience of that is the full ripening, the experience of being born as a human. Okay? Now, the feeling, this is me, that is not full ripening. Right? Another example might be, as the result of full ripening of karma, then you, as a result of full ripening of karma, you meet Trungpa Rinpoche. Okay, now when you meet Trungpa Rinpoche, the visual consciousness that sees Trungpa Rinpoche and experiences either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, that is the full ripening, right? Now, in your mind, when you feel faith, that is not full ripening. It may be conditioning from karma. It may be the result of aspirations that you've made, but it's not the full ripening. The full ripening is just the fact that you're able to meet Trungpa Rinpoche or some other great master, right?
So it's like a pinpoint.
Well, it's like you've got an experience of, you're experiencing the result, and it's just a sensation of some sort that's coming through any one of your consciousnesses, any one of the six consciousnesses. It may last for a while. Not necessarily a pinpoint. The moment that it occurs, you can talk about moments in two ways. You can talk about a moment as like the most shortest period of time, or you can talk about a moment in terms of the length of time, the duration of an action, the duration of something. So it might be the duration of experience, you know. Okay? Yeah. Is that clear enough?
So what you're saying is it's something that you can repeat over and over again. It's not something that's like fully ripened and that's it.
the first time that you know, whether meeting Trungpa Rinpoche is the full ripening of karma is very difficult to say, and I can't say it. Taking birth definitely is the full ripening of karma.
But then you have to go from there.
And there is a lot of karma that ripens upon us in our lives. You know, another one that we probably are more familiar with is the idea of, as full ripening of karma, is that you get stricken by some sort of an illness that comes up from genetic causes. That's full ripening. Mm-hmm. That's the same thing. That's the full ripening of karma. You've got that condition that causes that. Causes that conditioning. And that experience of the full ripening lasts as long as the illness lasts.
Interesting.
Peter?
I appreciated that you couched these in terms of the fruition of positive karma, the human birth meeting Trungpa Rinpoche, and then you mentioned that it could be of the ripening, full ripening of negative karma, which could be the sickness. So that's an example of fruition of negative karma. Mm-hmm. Right? And then what else would be, when you say example, so you've done harm in some ways to other beings. So, and that happens to you in this life. Is that seen as the fruition of that negative karma?
If you experience harm from another being in your life, it can be either what is called the full ripening result. It might be the dominant result of it. There are various things. There are different types of results. There are five different types, classified as five different types of results. And so whether something is a result of full ripening or not is difficult to distinguish for us. Karma is extremely complex, and we're talking in kind of general ideas. When you start looking at it to say, okay, this is the cause, this is a result of full ripening, this is a dominant result, this is a compatible result, you know, it gets really hard to start differentiating from these. In fact, it's said that only the Buddha can really understand it all. You know, each of the individual colors of a peacock feather is the result of karma. And so only the Buddha can understand where each of those individual results comes out of. Yes?
I think I had a completely wrong view of karma, but now I'm not sure. I'm very confused. But I'm so happy to hear this view about karma as being neutral, about full ripening. It's never been explained this intricately in detail before. But what I am confused about is what I thought karma had more to do with, like, with my own mind stream, in taking myself as an inherently solid person, and everything I do has a sense of self, or seeing it with the view of emptiness, independent arising, that if I have a view of emptiness, then whatever happens, I don't take as something solid and real, and so my actions don't come from a place of craving or desire or aggression. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem that that's true. It seems like that's more what happens after the physical performance, or the physical the ripening happens. Is that the ripening is just, I meet Chöngo Rinpoche, or the ripening is just, I have the illness, or is part of the karma how I feel about it, you know, how I take it.
The occurrence, getting the illness, meeting Chöngo Rinpoche, is the result of one karma, because of one action in the past, or some action in the past. Maybe so you experience the result of some action. You meet Chöngo Rinpoche. That creates a feeling in you, positive, negative, neutral. People have all three sorts of feelings. Mm-hmm. So you meet Chöngo Rinpoche, you feel a positive feeling of faith. That feeling of faith stimulates you, or motivates you to do something virtuous. Right. That's a new karma. That's a different. That's not the result of the previous karma. That's you actually acting on something positive. That's something you have control over.
Right.
Is
that karma?
That is an action.
Right.
Now, as an action, if it is a defiled action, if you are doing it without an understanding of the nature of how things actually are, then it is probably a defiled virtue, if you're doing something virtuous, which is going to lead to a good result in this realm, which is pretty good. You know, it's actually pretty rare. I mean, if you look at the number of virtuous things we do. Now, what you're talking about in terms of view of emptiness and so forth is when we do actions, if we do the actions and we're motivated by a selfish sense, a sense of me, or out of the afflictions, you know, the greed, hatred, or delusion, then that is, those are the actions that produce karmic results. And generally they motivate us to do, if it's the afflictions, it motivates us to do non-virtuous actions. So what we're talking about when we say if you realize emptiness or the nature of the mind, mm-hmm. then you don't commit new karma. What that means is that when you realize emptiness or the nature of mind, mm-hmm. then you eliminate the afflictions.
Right.
It's because of the afflictions that we do karma. The defiled virtue karma, virtuous karma, and the unvirtuous karma all are accompanied by afflictions. Defiled virtuous karma is accompanied by the affliction of the view of the personality view and the view of permanence, usually. So wrong view. So those are both forms of wrong view. Mm-hmm. But they're neutral. you can have those, because they're neutral, you can have those views and still do virtuous things. They aren't exclusive of doing virtuous things.
Okay, that's...
But they bring you to do virtuous things that have results in samsara, mm-hmm. which are not free of the suffering of change or of the pervasive suffering of formation.
Right.
Right. So, when you have a stable realization of emptiness, mm-hmm. you automatically eliminate the coarse afflictions. So you eliminate all the afflictions that would motivate you to actually do anything unvirtuous.
Mm-hmm.
You eliminate the view of personality and the wrong view at the same time. And so you wouldn't do the defiled virtue either. You'd only do undefiled virtue, which has an undefiled result, which is the greater bodhisattva levels in Buddhahood.
Okay, so this is what we want to do.
Yeah.
You know, this is this is what would stop the karmic result.
That's what would stop. Basically, when we talk about suffering comes from karma and afflictions, so suffering is a direct result of karma.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to stop doing karma. And in order to stop doing karma, we have to. Excuse me, I got a cramp in my calf. There we go.
Thanks.
Yeah, now I'm better. So we've got the defiled karma that I got distracted.
Sorry.
Okay, so we have the two aspects of the truth of it wasn't you. It was the cramp in my leg. It was Steve. You don't need to apologize.
No,
the cramp in my leg.
That's
either the result of my karma or it's the result of bad posture. And so the truth of the origin has two parts, karma and the afflictions, and we have to know how to deal with both of them. When we meditate on Mahamudra, we're doing this in order to remove the afflictions as well as all the cognitive obscurations that that underlie them. So that prevents us from doing karma, because karma all comes out of a defiled karma all comes out of some of the out of the afflictions. It either comes out of a non-virtuous thing, like the non-virtuous emotions, greed, etc., or it comes out of some neutral thing, like delusion, personality view, and so forth.
But the karma itself is a neutral.
Ripening of karma is neutral. The action itself can be either virtuous, unvirtuous, or neutral. Okay? The result of the action, think about it. When you do something, just look at the motivation in your mind. Is my motivation virtuous, unvirtuous, or neutral when you're doing something? You'll see that that actions can be done virtuously and they can be done unvirtuously. Mm-hmm. You can even make an offering of incense with an unvirtuous motivation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to make this offering of incense so beautifully that people will think I'm a saint and praise me forever.
Mm-hmm.
That's unvirtuous. Right? Yeah, go ahead.
One of the things that we've discussed on a few occasions in response to Dharma texts is it seems like there are afflictions, common intense afflictions and behavioral patterns in the relative world now that are completely analogous to the lower realms. I'll use an example of addiction and the hungry ghost realm.
Mm-hmm.
And when we've from what I'm understanding now, since that's not at least wholly physical, it's not really karma, but rather maybe the intense habituation through many lifetimes that leads to these sorts of hungry ghost behavior in this world. But what is the relationship, the conditioning relationship between life and other realms through many lifetimes and our tendencies now?
Basically, as ordinary sentient beings, we have all of the afflictions present within our mind streams on some level. They may be very subtle. Some of us, you know, we have predilections towards some afflictions more than others. Mm-hmm. Some people get angry very easily. They're what we call in Tibetan, they're called very lungtsao, very hot wind, you know. And some people have more predilections to love, you know, or kindness. Some people have more predilections to greed. These predilections, they're the result of habituation, which is what we would call the compatible result of both karma and also of your habitual thought tendencies. So all sentient beings, whether, you know, they're in the hell realms or whether in the god realms or in the human realm or wherever, all sentient beings have these afflictions within their beings. And so when we have presentations, I think that this talk about the other realms as analogs for human states, or actually it's the other way around. The human states are actually the experiences we have of hatred as an analog for the hell realm. Sometimes people misunderstand this. Sometimes people read Chogyam Trungpa's Cutting Through Spiritual Realism. They read this passage and they think, oh, okay, hell realm is just really feeling angry. No, that's just feeling angry in this life. Through experience that feeling of anger and hatred in this life, we can come to understand the suffering of beings in the hell realm. But it's not saying that hell realms are merely our own life. If it were saying our own psychological states, if it were saying that the hell realms were merely our own psychological states, then we would also have to say that the animal realms are merely people feeling deluded. So that cow over there is Aunt Edith having a bad day, or Uncle Ed having a bad day. No, that's a cow. That's not a human, it's a cow, right? If it were human, you wouldn't eat steak. Right? We can see animals. Now, the other realms, we do have the issue with the other realms of... we don't see the hell realms. And so we don't necessarily believe that they're there. A lot of us don't really believe. Furthermore, we have this sort of instinctual reaction that any time you hear the word hell, you think of Protestant preachers who are talking about hellfire and brimstone and Puritans and burning witches and all this stuff, and we don't like that. Right. So we've got a lot of cultural associations with the idea of there being a hell realm. And frankly, when you think about hell realm, it's like, if you're bad, someone else is going to send you to hell realm, the hell. When we think about how it actually works, we've got these strong negative states. So we do something in this life that creates a strong impression of that. We kill someone in this life. If you murder someone in this life, that is a very strong negative impression on your mind stream. And then when you die, at the moment of your death, that negative state is so strong that it takes over your perception, like we're talking about the world and all the bardos being just your projections. So your projections are coming out of that negative state. And so because of that, negative projections that we're making, we have even stronger negative reactions, which create all the appearances of the hell realms. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Okay. For the beings who are in the hell realms are just as real for them as they are for us. As the hell realms are just as real for them as the human realm is for us. But just because we can't see it doesn't mean that it's necessarily there. If we said that just because you can't see something doesn't mean it's there, then we'd have to all say, most of us would have to say that we do not have gallbladders because we have never seen them. I don't have a pancreas because I haven't seen it. It doesn't work that way, right? Yes?
Well, if you get into the hell realm, how does a person who's in the hell realm get out of the hell
realm? Very, very difficult. That's the worst part about it. In the lower realms, there is very, very little opportunity to practice virtue. You're in such a painful situation, such a difficult situation, and everyone's being aggressive, that you're aggressive to everyone and everyone's aggressive back to you, it's almost impossible to do something positive. And so this is why the hells or the hungry ghosts are such terrible states to be. We can even look at it with the animal realm. There are stories of animals that do virtuous things, wonderful. A lot of dogs especially. A lot of stories about dogs doing virtuous things. Other animals do some virtuous things, but not so many. And some don't do any at all. Some trying to do virtuous things end up only doing non-virtuous things. They try to take care of their young. So what do? They kill. Mommy bird has baby birds in the nest. Mommy bird goes out, gets a worm, brings it back to the baby bird, teaches the baby bird how to kill. So the baby bird is killing because it eats the worm that mom's bought back in the beak. And mom bird is, you know, helping it kill. So they've both got the bad karma of doing it, you know. So you think those robins look real nice and so sweet and innocent.
Murderers.
No, but if you think about it, it is so difficult to get to the position that we are in. Because it is so difficult to get to this position, we have to use the position now that we have to use the opportunities that we have at this point. This is the understanding karma really helps us understand, you know, we have the four general foundations. We have precious human birth. Boy, it's pretty precious. It's pretty rare. You know, it's so hard to get to this state where you're even doing any virtue at all. Even if you're born as a human, how many humans actually do virtuous things? How many do, and if you look, okay, a lot of humans do virtuous things. How many humans have sort of a balance of virtue and non-virtue? And how many humans have a predominance? I mean, when you look at your own motivations, how many of your actions are motivated by virtuous mind states? How many are motivated by neutral mind states? How many are motivated by negative, non-virtuous mind states? And if you really look at it, the non-virtuous and the negative mind states are pretty hard to resist, and we act out of them a lot. So this is why karma is such an important topic. It really makes us realize how much we have to practice. Yeah. Kirsten.
I'm just curious, given that you know, our lineage is the Karma Kagyu, and that we're learning about this, and if you could just speak about that, how it is that our lineage carries that.
Karma Kagyu. The word Sanskrit word karma can be used in two ways. One is what we translate as action. Uh-huh. The other is activity. So we, like the Buddha is the, or the Karmapa is the manifestation of the activity of the Buddhas. And so that's why we're the Karmakaju lineage. Is that?
So it's not any specific teachings that are about karma that are...
No, it's specifically that a title that was given during the time of the second karma, Karmapakchi, as the manifestation of the activity of all the Buddhas.
It's not our responsibility to understand karma better than all the other
lineages. It's our responsibility to understand it well enough that we can that we can use it to our advantage. I think, Jeb, you had a question.
There are humorous stories about animals being reborn as humans during the time of the Buddha and taking ordination based on accumulating virtuous karma by accident.
Yeah.
Like, how does that work? Maybe the answer is, you know, only the Buddha knows, but you have something else to say about
just
that.
Just because an animal is... most animals, although on the one hand I just said that they basically do things like killing all the time, they don't do it on the same level as we do. They don't do it with the same strength of intention. I mean, pretty much humans are the best at killing out of hatred, you know. And so they don't have a strong intention. It doesn't, and when they kill, killing a worm is a lot less, because a worm has a lot less potential for liberation, it's not as serious as killing a human. So for that reason, even though they do accumulate a lot of negative karma, they do also do things that can be virtuous. Like the pig who chases the cat around the stupa three times, and they're both reborn as arhats. You know, and they're both reborn as humans and turn into arhats. This is, you know, the strength of the field. We were talking about this here. Karma has what is it? To the field of qualities. You've got the stupa, the Buddha, you know, because they're doing it to such a great being. They're sort of paying respects out to a great being out of some way, in some sort of way. You know, it is hard to conceive, but because of the excellence of the field, sense of the field, and also in the same way when we do life releases, we can also, you know, say the mantra of Akchobhya or whatever other Buddha, and the being hears that, and they don't have any response to it, but it plants a seed somehow because of the blessings of the Buddha, the power of the Buddha. Yes?
When we dedicate merit, is that helping if we dedicate our merit to somebody in the ghost realm? Will that help them get out quicker?
For karma to ripen, you have to have the cause and the conditions. So that being who's in a ghost realm or wherever, some unfortunate state, in their being they have to have the cause of getting out of it. Because they've had an infinite number of lifetimes, there probably is the cause somewhere in their being. But you also have to have the conditions that bring it together. And that can, and our own positive aspirations can be the conditions. Yeah.
I'm not sure how to ask this, but something about, I'm thinking about Hitler and somebody who, like, this is a fortune, like, you have to have accumulated a lot of good action and karma to have a human birth. But if you have a human birth, like somebody who comes in and, say, is angry and hateful and killing people, and how does that reflect positivity in the last life?
You have two different types of karma. You've got propelling karma and completing karma. We'll get to those soon. Where is the... it's coming up. Verse 95. We'll get to that. Basically, different types of karma. And the fact that Hitler... It wasn't Hitler's karma to cause the deaths of 40 million people. That was his action. That wasn't the result of his karma. That was an action that he did that is causing other results. Amy?
I was really interested in the what you said about guilt. I think it was last night.
Uh-huh.
And self-loathing, and then when you were talking about the four purifications, regret. And I was trying to think about the difference between guilt and regret, and I thought one difference is with guilt there's aggression against the self.
Uh-huh.
Then I was thinking, what happens karmically to that? Like if your aggression is directed to yourself, what's the karmic result of that?
Peter was asking about this at breakfast too.
We do that a lot in this culture.
We do it a lot in this culture. It depends on what you do out of the aggression to yourself. If out of aggression to yourself you end up hurting yourselves and other sentient beings, that's unvirtuous, right? Mm-hmm. If out of aggression to yourself you make yourself do 100,000 prostrations in 3 weeks just so that you can prove that you can do it or whatever. I know people who've done it in 3 weeks. Tulku Dhamsha. If you do that, then it's a slightly different matter. Yeah. Because what you're doing is counteracting the aggression at a certain level. It's a defiled virtue then. You're doing something defiled and virtuous. And then it leads to that. It's not the best way, it's not the most skillful way to go about it, but you're getting yourself to do something good, so not all bad. Right. On the other hand, if you really want to be able to sustain your practice on the spiritual path, you can't really do it out of a sense of aggression at yourself. I think once you get to, the further you go along the spiritual, you know, the Buddhist path, the less aggressive we are towards ourselves as well as towards other sentient beings. Yeah.
I wondered, with going back to a person killing someone else, and say if there's someone, well, there are many people we know right here in our daily experience that have killed others, and is there a way, but yet they might have done that maybe in an earlier life, and then they've done good things since then. However,
yeah.
They're carrying a lot of really negative stuff.
Yeah.
And we want to help them, or I want to help them. Is it possible through my practice that I can purify those actions for them so that they don't carry them into the bardo?
They have to do the purification themselves, but through your practice you can help. You can't actually do the purification. For the common example is through a Tonglen meditation, take away all the causes of their future suffering. So visualize it, taking it upon yourself. It does not actually take away that, but it might create enough compassion in your being and enough wisdom in your being that you will be able to help them actually purify themselves.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So it'll have an indirect result, may have an indirect result for them. Generally, we've all done such horrible things in so many times in the infinite number of past lives that there's no reason to have anything other than compassion for people who are just like us.
But killing and collective karma, I mean, collectively we have created conditions and places in the world where killing is inevitably going to be more probable, common, and likely.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that there is some collective accountability to that, and for the individual who's killing in that environment, their individual karma doesn't own all of that. So what about purifying for the purpose of collective karma?
We can purify our selves about. This is talked about in verse 72. When killers die before or else together, there is no actual. They've been born in another body. In wars, etc., all of them have the same goal, so all possess the karma like the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll discuss this issue this afternoon. Yes. Oh, Sheerston,
okay.
It is your hand. I saw this hand come up there. I couldn't see the arm.
I'm just curious in the text about you spoke a little bit about it, I think, in response to Jeb's question, but the use of the word field, it's used...
Oh.
Field of intention, and also where is it?
To the field of qualities.
Yeah, I just was curious if you could speak more about
group. The group, the set, the group, the bunch of people. That's basically all it means.
Okay.
The field of qualities, all those folks who have qualities, parents, teachers, Buddhas, great beings, and so forth.
And then when it says from the excellence of field of intention,
so excellence of field, so you're giving to like the Buddhas, the Arhats, the Sangha. And intention, so it's not, so excellence of intention. Yeah, those are two separate things, excellence of field and excellence of intention.
Okay, thank you.
Yes?
I'm interested in what karma is and where it comes from, how does it run? Like, what's the machine that's running it? And is it just energy? Is it, maybe that's asking like exactly how big the universe is. But
in a certain level, it is. It's like, It's when you do something, it creates an effect on your mind. For example, if you smoke a cigarette, it creates an effect on your mind, which leads to an experience, to a feeling of, which tends to create a feeling of craving. So then you want to smoke a second cigarette, and then you smoke a third, and then in 6 months you're up to 5 packs a day. It's like, this is an action that's creating a result, the result being, this is not a result of ripening, this is a compatible result, but habituating yourself to it. So it's creating something in your mind, a tendency in your mind stream that is going to then ripen in some way. So like last night I used the example of a river, if you have all sorts of silt in a river. Another way you can think about it, you've got the river, the mountain stream flowing down, lovely babbling brook. You throw a rock in it, it's going to have an effect on the flow. If you throw a big enough rock, it's going to change the direction of the stream, right? So it's like you've got this stream that's just the continuation of our consciousness, and we're doing something that affects the flow of that. And that can have an effect later when we later in a way that we can see in a short term, or in a way that we don't see later on. You put a new rock in it. It doesn't change in the stream. It doesn't seem to change the effect of the stream, but then it ends up, you know, directing enough water in a way that it undercuts the bank and changes the course of the stream gradually over the course of a whole pile of years. You know, so that's the sort of analogy I've been sort of thinking about for myself. But basically what it's saying is you create an effect on your mind, and then causes further disturbances further along, whether it becomes, you know, habituation through the compatible result, or whether it's provoking some sort of new appearance, as in a full ripening result.
So instead of being this huge omniscient thing, it's each of us has our own stream.
We have our own stream of karma.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, no, it's not just one thing. It's not just some mass. And when we talk about collective karma, what we're really saying is that at that point, all the streams of karma are flowing in parallel. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I understand it correctly, a meeting with Rinpoche may or may not be the result of karmic ripening.
Yeah.
But is the awareness of the opportunity that meeting would present the results of karmic ripening?
Probably not, because that's a virtuous cognition. That's faith, right?
Mm-hmm. Is having that faith, though, a part of karmic ripening?
Having the faith, that is the attainment of faith, which is itself, is that virtue or unvirtue? It's probably not karmic ripening. It's probably the result, a compatible result of karma. In other words, the result of habituation, but it's probably not the karmic ripening. On the other hand, it's a very real result. I can't explain anything that's happened to me in the last 12 years other than thinking, boy, I must have really done something right in previous lives.
That simplicity I find helpful. Yes. If you get so finely tuned, I think it's wonderful to have this deep investigation, but I always have to come full circle to just as what you said.
Yeah.
It's just like, I'm not sure I get this, but this pretty amazing cool demonstration of previous okayness.
Well, we have to remember that karma itself, I mean, the whole idea of karma, it's like a tool. The understanding of it is a tool that we can use to help ourselves, and that's really what we need to do. We need to make sure that we use this understanding of karma in order to bring ourselves closer to our ultimate goal. We all have suffering. We all have pains. Everyone does. Mental pains, physical pains, whatever sort of pain they are, we all experience them. And so if we understand where that comes from, where our own pains come from, we can help other beings as well. That brings us, understanding this just brings us a step closer to actually being able to awaken to Buddhahood. This is what we're doing it for. We're not. This is not some dry mental exercise, and it's not just. It's not a dry mental exercise, and it's not just, enjoying life better. Mm-hmm. Enjoying life is better is probably an indirect result of it. But really, the reason that we need to do this is because there is so much suffering, and we have no choice but to try to get rid of it now while we have an opportunity for ourselves and for others. Yeah.
Is karma and birth always a linear process? And do enlightened beings, when they incarnate in several forms at once,
Can you talk about that? Like, our karma extreme incarnates in one
body.
One body at one period of time, and it's this linear progression from past to future.
But then you have beings like Jamgon Kontra Lodratai who reincarnated in five bodies. Yeah. So basically, on a relative level, you've got one stream of karma, you have one stream of consciousness, basically, that goes from one lifetime to the next life to the next life in a linear fashion for ordinary sentient beings. When you have beings who attain the bodhisattva levels, then they don't take birth from karma. On the impure bodhisattva levels, they sort of take birth out of the imprints of desire, which manifests as love and compassion. And so they're taking birth out of love and compassion, and because they're not taking birth out of karma, they take birth intentionally. But also when you attain the level of a bodhisattva, the first level bodhisattva is able to emanate 100, is it 100 or is it, it's 100 emanations of themselves. And so with a being like Lodratai, Jamgon Kontra Lodratai, who realized the nature of how things are, realized the bodhisattva levels, it's just natural that he's able to manifest in ways that are inconceivable to us ordinary beings.
Is there still a stream at that point, or is it just this vastness of something for an enlightened being?
It depends on whose perspective you look at it. When you look at it from the relative perspective of us looking up at them, it looks like a stream that maybe separates into different streams for different beings, the five Kontra, the Dzigar Kontra, Jamgon Kontra, the other Kontra Tulkus. Or you look at the Buddha, and the Buddha manifests in many different ways. From their perspective, in the appearance of a Buddha, the Buddha sees the illusory nature of all of it, and so the Buddha is just only aware of the Dharmakaya in their own perspective. So there's nothing other than the Dharmakaya and their perception. And yet at the same time, they're able to perceive how we see it.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
You said that there's not a lot of books written about the complexities that you're teaching us. Is there any book you might recommend that we could keep studying? Because for me, this is challenging to...
Yeah, it's a lot of information. Well, okay, we're recording this so you can listen to recordings. that's what this is here. And so listening is good. Books in English, there are some academic translations of the Abhidharma that are already out that you can look at, but they may be difficult to understand. This translation of the root text of the Treasury is part of is a translation that I have done that will be published by next September by KTD Publications in a book called Jewels of the Treasury. Mm-hmm. And it will include the Vasubandhu's root verses as well as Wangshut Dorje's explanation of them. So that will be published by next September. It's still not entirely you won't mistake the writing for Pema Chodron's. It's you have to think about it a lot, and it's really complex because there are things that are mentioned in the first chapter that aren't explained until the eighth chapter. There's something mentioned in the first chapter, and then you have to remember what it was back when you see the word the next time in the eighth chapter. So it's like this web of stuff that you have to sort of get the whole before you can start really understanding it. But if you get it and start looking at it, it can be helpful, but it's not light reading. I think maybe we are coming close to, I don't know, should I say lunchtime, or should I say your limits for the sort of limits of what we can sustain? So right now we will just say the dedication for merit. We'll say the longer dedication prayers at the end of the afternoon session.